My fellow Americans, today our armed forces joined our NATO allies in airstrikes against Serbian forces responsible for the brutality in Kosovo. We have acted with resolve for several reasons. We act to protect thousands of innocent people in Kosovo from a mounting military offensive. We act to prevent a wider war, to defuse a powder keg at the heart of Europe that has exploded twice before in this century with catastrophic results. And we act to stand united with our allies for peace. By acting now, we are upholding our values, protecting our interests, and advancing the cause of peace. Tonight, I want to speak with you about the tragedy in Kosovo and why it matters to America that we work with our allies to end it. First, let me explain what it is we are responding to. Kosovo is a province of Serbia in the middle of southeastern Europe, about 160 miles east of Italy. That's less than the distance between Washington and New York, and only about 70 miles north of Greece. Its people are mostly ethnic Albanian and mostly Muslim. In 1989, Serbia's leader, Slobodan Milosevic, the same leader who started the wars in Bosnia and Croatia and moved against Slovenia in the last decade, stripped Kosovo of the constitutional autonomy its people enjoy, thus denying them their right to speak their language, run their schools, shape their daily lives. For years, Kosovars struggled peacefully to get their rights back. When President Milosevic sent his troops and police to crush them, the struggle grew violent. Last fall, our diplomacy, backed by the threat of force from our NATO alliance, stopped the fighting for a while and rescued tens of thousands of people from freezing and starvation in the hills where they had fled to save their lives. And last month, with our allies and Russia, we proposed a peace agreement to end the fighting for good. The Kosovar leaders signed that agreement last week. Even though it does not give them all they want, even though their people were still being savaged, they saw that a just peace is better than a long and unwinnable war. The Serbian leaders, on the other hand, refused even to discuss key elements of the peace agreement. As the Kosovars are saying yes to peace, Serbia stationed 40,000 troops in and around Kosovo in preparation for a major offensive and in clear violation of the commitments they had made. Now they've started moving from village to village, shelling civilians and torching their houses. We've seen innocent people taken from their homes, forced to kneel in the dirt and sprayed with bullets. Kosovar men dragged from their families, fathers and sons together, lined up and shot in cold blood.
GlobalRecon.net, giving you the matter of facts. Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. Co-hosting with me for this episode, back on the podcast, is Chantel Taylor, author of the book Battle Worn, retired British Army combat medic. Chantel, how's it going?
Hey, it's good, John. How are you?
I'm good. I am good. So, for this episode, I had a conversation with a retired Slovenian special operations medic. He has some interesting experiences. You know, we'll get into that in a second. But Chantel, he had a rotation into the Balkans. I know you have some experiences there yourself, right?
Yeah, that was actually one of my first operational tours, was to Kosovo in 1999, and it was yes, it's an interesting place actually. It's a different place. It's kind of it's quite a dark place, and the stuff that was going on there was quite harrowing actually. I mean, it's obviously the lead on from Bosnia, that was just as horrific, and then it just sort of went on to that whole sort of region was affected. Yeah, that was quite for a first tour for me as a junior medic and a junior soldier. That was actually quite rough and cold, which is interesting for me to say as a Brit.
Yeah. So I know, and it's kind of, you know, that entire region has a very deep history, and it's kind of an interesting place because, you know, throughout history, the Balkans kind of sat in the way of conquering armies going either east or west. So, you know, whatever army was on top of the world at that time had to pass through there to get to the other part of the known world, you know. So it was like...
Yeah, sure. And it is. And it's, and they still... I found their methods of... either, you know, the methods of either getting rid of people or terrorizing people were pretty barbaric, you know. But, you know, back in sort of the olden times, the methods were pretty savage. And, you know, for the longest time we had teams, I'd operated on the border with Serbia, with little sort of recon teams around the border that used to just sort of protect the area. But we had teams that were out with the digging up the mass graves and stuff of where they basically just executed entire villages. And that was pretty heavy stuff. You know, because you often find, this is, I think, what we forget sometimes, is soldiers don't only deal with combat and the sort of art of war, but you have to deal with things like, you know, piecing together incidences where entire families are wiped out. And what happens is, the bodies are discovered and then, or recovered, if you like, and then the story has to be pieced together. So along with the Canadian, I'm sure so there were some other international police forces involved, you know, our soldiers had to go in and excavate, you know, dig up these graves too. So that was quite tough. You know, it's those sorts of conflicts. I'm not saying they've been forgotten about, but because the conflicts we've been involved in have been far more kinetic of late, you do tend to forget the psychological effects from those places are probably sometimes a little bit worse, because you do see the kind of really dark side of humanity there.
Yeah, it's very ugly. And I actually happened to grow up having some Albanian friends. And I remember when that was happening, some of their fathers went over there to help in some capacity, you know, with the efforts. And, you know, I believe in Kosovo, they had like small groups of resistance fighters.
Yeah, they did.
But, you know, against a professional military, you know, backed by the Russians, they really didn't have much of a chance.
No. And like, you know, those, they would go in and just do raids on entire sort of villages and wreak havoc in those places. It was a shitty time. And at the end, you know, again, this is going to sound crazy, but I remember through all the sort of places I've been in my life, I always seem to find places with dogs. And Kosovo was exactly the same. You know, every sort of conflict region, regardless of where it is, there's always dogs left, you know, strewn around the place.
Right.
And you and I would obviously just, our previous conversation, we're talking about a pit bull. But, you know, when you've got sort of wild packs of dogs just cutting around, they kind of, I suppose the reason I bring it up is because it's not always as simple as, you know, moving from cover to cover, because packs of dogs can be quite dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and in every sort of conflict I've been in, there's always packs of dogs everywhere. And you're like, geez, you know, it's almost like, you know, you have to, it's things that you're not really taught, you know, that while I was in basic training, no one ever mentioned dogs, you know, no one ever said, oh, there's packs of dogs cutting around that you need to deal with.
And it's kind of weird like that, because I guess they're everywhere, like the Middle East, or, you know,
Eastern Europe. And weird. And even in like, you know, I'd sort of revert back to Afghan again, but the dogs in Afghan are like little tanks, because they're bred for fighting. And these dogs are like, you know, you find beautiful dogs, don't get me wrong. I mean, we used to always end up, you'd always end up with pets and stuff like that. But some of them are just nasty, vicious sort of beasts.
Yeah.
And you don't want that coming down your hallway at you.
Right.
And but again, it's an interesting tactic. And we always discuss these sort of strange things. We all go through our training and it's all very clinical and everything happens. I'm not saying happens the way we want it to, but then you throw that into the mix. What do you do? Because you're fine. You can shoot the dog, but it's a moving target at the end of the day. And it's coming at you. If I'm talking like, you know, if you're in sort of close quarter combat, but you just kind of, don't forget the dogs, guys.
And you know, it's interesting. I was watching a documentary a couple of years ago, and they briefly touched on the conflict over there, and they interviewed like some Serbian journalist and I guess former kind of high government officials within the Serbian government, and they all like had this attitude like the United States intervening there, and you know they had done some bombing. I guess there was some like Allied bombing and on specific targets within Serbia, and they were talking about it like it was such an outrage, but they had no problem with basically a genocide that was going on that would have kept on going on had the United States and you know Britain and their allies not intervened. And I remember looking like, what the fuck are these people talking about? Like, you know?
Yeah, and it's concerning because that, and they genuinely feel that way. It's almost like you know, they were ethnically cleansing people and doing it in a way that there was no kind of it didn't happen by accident. It wasn't a case of, oh shit, this is happening, we're gonna have to just, they were ethnically cleansing that country, and to think that that's okay, and oh, you shouldn't bomb, you know, it pisses me off because I just think, well, hang on, you know, that's not because the knock-on effect is you can leave that. You can keep – that can continue to happen. And you can think, you know what, we're not going to get involved and stuff. But what will happen is the ripple effect, that will eventually reach you.
Right, in some way. In
some form.
Yeah. And then the Serbians will then get bolder and bolder and start, you know, tumbling into the other countries in that area. And, you know –
that's exactly what happens. You know, it's just – because if as soon as people start to fold and, I mean – you know, you can look at Hitler and his sort of, as soon as he starts to take countries and people, what can happen is that spreads. And then you get to a point where you kind of, you know, you're stuck in a position where it's you and them.
Right. And it's like, you know, you're in those type of situations, in my opinion, you're better off stopping it before it spreads. And that's kind of, if you want to go back to like 2014 when ISIS started making their push across into Iraq, you know, they were executing thousands of people. And you know, at some point, a lot of the Iraqi army divisions who were in the north and in the area closer to Syria, they didn't fight at all. They just fled and, you know, left all their equipment behind, that kind of thing. And what's interesting is, you know, even throughout the kind of craziness that's been Iraq for the past 15 years, they have a unit within the Iraqi military known as the Iraqi Special Operations Forces that were trained by Army Green Berets. And what's interesting about them is they are a collection of different ethnicities and religious faiths, but they all work together. And they're actually a very professional unit, and they've been constantly fighting, you know, since like 2005, I think, when they were trained up. And ISOF, they almost single-handedly held ISIS back from taking the entire Iraq. And I mean, with support from, you know, Western air forces and stuff like that, but these guys really held it down. And
And that's the thing. I mean, I was during my time in, you know, as a contract in Iraq, I was there from 2011 until 2015. So we've seen, you know, that country go from, and it was in a really a good place at one point. You know, we were driving the sort of width and breadth of that country. And although obviously we have our own intelligence sort of gathering methods in the way that we conduct our own business, but it was relatively safe for people. You know, the people of the country were going about their business. They were sort of getting back on their feet. And I remember seeing in the early days when they were sort of rising up of the concerning way that they were sort of cutting around murdering Iraqi troops. And it was done, you know, in an extremely cold way, where I think it was quite shocking for those, because those men that were sort of manning some of the checkpoints, they weren't high speed soldiers, or they were, you know, they were just there, you know, sort of filing people through and doing what they do.
Right.
You know, that's how those cultures are, and that's fine if it works, if you haven't got lunatics running around. But obviously then they became very easy targets. So it probably took a unit like that to actually, like you say, to stop that tidal wave just ripping through the entire country, because they were in some sort of positions where Baghdad was very close to. Well, obviously bombs did get through, but It's how many you can take, isn't it? It's how many before you just become completely lawless.
Right. And yeah, Baghdad was actually like they were close to it. Yeah. And then they got stopped at a certain point. I forget exactly where, but, you know, they almost made their push into Baghdad. But what's interesting now is that, you know, I mean, everyone pretty much knows ISIS days, you know, owning land how they do now are numbered. You know, it's just after they take Mosul and then they, I guess, maybe they'll push harder into Syria. You know, then it turns into this insurgency type of thing again, you know, it's like suicide bombs and that sort of thing. But,
yeah,
you know, it's
funny you say that, John, because then sort of going back to a conversation of that's not Kosovo. But if it's not dealt with, what happens is that it encroaches on everything. You know, if you leave these places bubbling, and I'm sort of kind of boring people with harping on about Africa. But the way that we sometimes leave these places bubbling away, and then it's almost like a big shock, not necessarily to military people, it's a big shock to society. Oh, how did that happen? Well, you know, if you leave places bubbling away for long enough, like any sort of volcano, it's going to explode at some point, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So, all right, so with that, now I'll get into the conversation that I had with our Slovenian Special Operations medic. Hey, what's going on, guys? On with me for this episode, this is a special guest, is Sidik. And Sidik is a former Slovenian Special Forces medic. Sidik, how's it going, brother?
All good, bro. All good, brother. How's it, Duran?
Everything is good, man. You know, Slovenia is a small country, European country. I'm sure you guys don't have a very large military, but you guys are active in the world and, you know, different type of capacities. So we'll talk about, you know, your career a little bit. And before we get into that, can we talk about, you know, what motivated you to join the Slovenian military?
I tell you the truth, bro. It was more like something that I always wanted to try. So when I finished high school, I had 1 year. I fucked up something at the end of the school with my grades. So I had 1 year of time. So I did like a 3-month basic training only. And then you don't have to stay in the military. So just like, you know, go do it. And then if in case of war, they call you. So I did that. And then I noticed I'm pretty good at it, so I just stayed in the army. So basically, like, not a big reason why I joined.
Okay, so is that kind of like a National Guard type of setup? Like that's kind of how in the States, you know, you have your or the reserves, you know, you do like a week and a month type of thing.
We have like you can go professionally in the army, so that means you go in the army and that's your job. Then you have the reserve. That means you do the basic training, and then once a year or some shit like that, then they call you. Or you can just go and do the basic training, and then you're out. You don't have nothing to do with the army. Basically, you just do the basic training, and then, like, in the case of war, they just call you up. Like, you don't have to go every year do, let's say, a week of training or something. You do the 3 months of basic training, and you're done.
That's kind of interesting. I guess that's a way, you know, for a smaller country to kind of stay ready.
Basically, it's like all of your, like, whoever decides, it's not mandatory, but whoever decides can go and try and then see if it's good for you. You can stay. If not, you'll still have some training. And then, again, like I said, in a case of a bigger, let's say, war or whatever, it's easier because you already have some people that have training, so you don't start from scratch.
Right. Yeah. Okay, and where is Slovenia located in Europe?
It's basically, some people call it Central Europe, some people call it still the Balkans. But it's basically, if you know where is Italy, it's basically east from Italy, south from Austria, and west from fucking Hungary. So it's between those three countries, and then on the south it's Croatia.
Is it like a mountainous terrain type of country, or?
It's a health app. We have Alps or we have the coast. So basically, whatever the fuck you want. It's a good thing if you go for a holiday. I recommend it.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So you did your basic training and then you realized you liked the soldiering, so you went back in full time. And now you were in the infantry when you first signed up full time?
Yeah, mechanized infantry.
Okay, and so what was that like for you? Was that like a lot of training? Did you do training in other countries or was that like more local for you?
Like I didn't basically when I finished with my school and then sign up for real, they put me in some more basic training basically. And after that, we can say I got I had to do some internal training. Let's say we have like a battalion here, which is like I always call it like a little bit better. And then if you want to get in that battalion, you have to do like small selection. We can call it like that. It's like basically, I think it was like 1 week or 2 weeks. Fucking forgot. It's just like, you know, they try to teach you all the shit that they do. And so it's like some kind of education selection program. So I did that. And then after that, they put me on a course for big guns. So basically the 40 Mic and 50 Cal. So I did that. And then I immediately went for training for the deployment for the fucking K4 to Kosovo. So I was pretty... How do you call this? Active when I came in. I got lucky.
So the rotation into Kosovo, you know, for anyone who's not familiar, Kosovo is a region right next to Albania, north of Montenegro, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
It's north of Montenegro and east of Serbia.
Yeah, basically.
So Kosovo is largely... ethnic Albanians. There was a large Albanian community there, but I believe it was under Serbian control at the time. And
it's like a Serbian holy land. I mean, they call it their holy land. They have a lot of prehistory of Serbia. It comes from there.
Okay. So they, I believe was it 1990 or it was somewhere in the early 90s?
Early 90s.
Yeah, early 90s, there was basically a genocide going on or ethnic cleansing with there's, I don't know if it was like Serbian militias or the Serbian military were basically just like militias.
Yeah.
So they were basically like just executing, you know, thousands of Albanians, like ethnic Albanians. And I believe they were majority Muslims. And it was a very bad problem. And then the United States intervened, I guess, with some sort of support from NATO and some other NATO countries. And, you know, it was pretty bad for a while, but, you know, they were able to kind of push the Serbs back a little bit. And I guess Kosovo, is it still under Serbian control now or no?
No, it's they got their independence, we can say. I don't know, a Serb still didn't recognize it, but they're like trying to get their own country. I mean, they have they have it, but they don't have it. I don't know. It's hard to, like, the same problem like with Kurds in, I would say, around Turkey and stuff, like if you know, just here it's a little bit bigger because Albanians have, Kosovo has their own flag and a government and everything, and it's recognized by some countries of the European Union, I mean, and the NATO and all this stuff. So, but they still have a lot of problems with the Serbs because they're not letting it go that easily.
Right. And then, of course, the Serbian government is backed by Moscow and the Russian, you know, so... I guess it's like it turns into a little bit of that kind of Cold War mentality.
Basically, yeah.
You know, like everyone's kind of caught up in that. So your rotation into Kosovo was a part of that peacekeeping mission?
Yeah, we did 6 months there as a basically let's say URF, crowd control, patrol. We did basically everything from patrolling the Serbs. We were there mostly basically to patrol the Serbs and Klavas, so basically where the Serbs majority was, to make sure that they didn't have that much problems with the Albanians. We did some border patrols, like trying to catch some illegal traffic going on, because there's a big route that goes through there, from drugs to prostitution to everything to weapons. So, and we also, like I said, provided URF for in case of any major, let's say, demonstrations or whatever. It was like, it was not focused, basically, deployment. We just did whatever the fuck they, you know, they needed us for.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so your deployment last was 6 months. Then you got back home, and then did you begin your, like, training and heading towards becoming a soft medic at that point, or how'd that work?
Basically, before I came home, I was supposed to go to a recon unit. Let's say they're not SF unit, but you know that they're like they're treated a little bit like a SF unit. Let's say. So I was thinking about joining them and be there like maybe for a year or two, and then joining the SF. But I had some problems with my basically lieutenant, with my platoon leader. So I can say that he fucked me up. And so when we got back from the deployment, he arranged for me to become a fucking security in a fucking Air Force base, doing like gate security and shit like that.
Right.
So basically after the deployment, they show me the Air Force base. So, and after that, I had a friend, and my best friend was with me there because he loved us, both of us. And he was already one time on the selection, so he was now preparing to go on the second time. And he was like, come on, join me, you know, we can go together, you know, what the fuck you're going to do here? You're going to be a security fucking guy all the fucking life, blah, blah, blah. You didn't join the military for this shit. So I was like, yeah, why the fuck not? So me and him started training. I mean, I started training with him for the selection, and then I worked there like maybe for a fucking 6 months. And then after 6 months, I went for the selection for the second unit.
And so I know here in the States, you know, obviously there's different soft units, so there's different requirements and selections times. But then I believe for any soft unit in the States, if you want to be a medic, the training is longer. So you can go through, you know, whatever requirements the unit has for anybody who's going into their selection.
Yeah.
And then you have to do the medical training as well. Is that something similar for Slovenian military?
Yeah, like let's say our unit is, when our unit was started, the SF unit, it was mostly like training with the SAS and the Navy SEALs. So after that, the selection program, and it came a little bit mixture of, let's say, the UK and the US. So with us is, when you want to join the SF unit, you have to do like, it's like 2 weeks of selection, which everybody has to do it, no matter if you're joining in the unit or you're joining the logistics or the support or whatever the fuck, you have to do those 14 days. After those 14 days, the guys who are applying for the combat part have to do 6 months of basic training, which is basically getting to learn. It's like a small ranger, basically, I say it like that. So you learn all the small unit tactics, some of the medical shit, or some of the, you know, engineering Charlie shit, some of the, let's say, weapons and stuff like that. And when you finish with the six months basic training, you get in the unit, and then you start doing your specialization. So in some terms, it's like a little bit different than, let's say, your U.S., let's say Green Berets, you know, you finish the selection and then you immediately go to the U course or 18 Delta or whatever you're going to be. Here you have to finish first the 6 months of basic training to get to know the unit tactics and all that stuff, and then you start with the specialization. Because we're, like you said, it's a small country, it's a small unit. We cannot have like everybody not knowing everything. So we have to work on basically everybody has to know everything until some point, and then you do the extra for your specialization.
Okay. And yeah. What is the name of the unit?
Special operation unit. In Slovenia, it's called Enota za specialno delovanje, but if I translate it to English, it's called special operation unit. So.
Okay. And so, you know, obviously in a country like the U.S. where there's such a large military, you know, there are units that are very specific to, you know, certain type of operations. You know, like one unit, SEALs, they're, I mean, obviously with the global war on terror, things have kind of gotten mixed up in terms of specialties and what type of operations units are taking on. But traditionally, it would be SEALs and the Marines would kind of have the maritime responsibility, and then the Army would take on some of the other responsibilities in terms of special operations mission sets. Is that something that's differentiated in the Slovenian military, or is it something where everybody is kind of responsible for the whole spectrum of operations?
Basically, like I said before, small country, small unit, we cannot, you know, afford basically to have, let's say, one team for this, one team for this. So what we tried to try to incorporate everything so everybody knows at least the basics for everything, and then maybe you have a ODA that's a little bit, you know, specialized in the maritime, you know, the other one is maybe a little bit specialized more for DA for direct actions and stuff like that. But like a unit, we try to get everybody to know at least the basics. So because it's really hard to stretch the small unit in, like, you know, to stretch it out. Okay, you're going to do this, you're going to do this, you're going to be specialized for this, you're going to be specialized for this. So basically, like I said, try to get everybody to know at least basics for all of the operations.
Right. And you know, that makes sense, I guess, you know, from the Slovenian military standpoint. All right. So now you make it into the unit. You become a special forces medic. You know, we spoke off there a little bit about it. You've done a lot of training, cross training, with American soft units. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Like I said, when I finished my basic training, I was not even maybe 2 months when I went to the States, me and one other guy. We did, for St. Houston, so we did like the EMTB and the 68 Whiskey Combat Medic course. And so that was the beginning of our cross training with the SF, I mean, with the US. I did like, 4 months or even more there. We did that, so, and then we came back. We did a couple cross training with mostly with Green Berets. We do so. We did some. Most of them we do back home or at the Grafenwöhr at Germany. So it really depends on the situation. What kind of training we do? A lot of, like I said, I did medical training. Then we had like PJs coming by, doing some medical training with us. It really depends, so, of the intentions, let's say. If we're getting pre-deployed, we get the unit we're going to deploy with. They come here, we go to Germany, so we get to know each other, stuff like that. So, like, I don't know if I can be more specific. Basically, we do everything.
Yeah. So as you did your combat medic course here in the States, and so for all soft units in the United States, regardless of, you know, what branch of the military you're in, everybody goes to the special operations medical course. which is run by the 18 Deltas, Green Berets. Yep. Is that a course that you attended?
Yeah, there's a, we try to send at least one guy a year there. So, so we also do that course basically. So, it used to be a little bit different. I can say it. Some of our guys that were there before, it was not that open, let's say, for foreign soldiers. But now they change it, so you do the whole fucking 9 months there. So you do basically the same course as the U.S. guy.
Right. Okay. So you know, in this global war on terror, there's been a lot of advancements in medical advancements, bleeding control, things like that, tourniquet use, and it's been reflected in the States with guys coming back and, you know, setting up medical courses and, you know, training police departments or, you know, whatever it is. And it's really like raised the level of awareness, and people are still attempting to raise that level even higher. Is that something that's been reflected in Slovenia as well?
The big problem about Slovenia is, I mean, a problem, it's a good thing and a bad thing, is it's a small country, you know. So a lot of people back home, or like a lot of people in the world, they don't see us. And then people back home also feel like they're safe, you know, because nobody sees them. So, like, medically wise, affecting people with this kind of knowledge is, yes, we did a lot of cross training with our, let's say, the police, especially the SWAT unit, stuff like that. But like getting the awareness to the people back home is a pretty hard thing, because people in Slovenia like to live in their bubble, you know, we're a small country, we're safe, nothing happens here and stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of work to be done there, but for now, like, people just don't find the motivation to, you know, how the fuck, you know, when you find something out and try to sell it, try to use it in public, everybody goes like, well, why the fuck we need this, you know, we're a safe country, nothing happens here. So it's not like the same in the States or anywhere else, because nothing happened at our home, they said, like that, you know, and people feel safe. So they don't need this knowledge.
Right.
And it's a big problem.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because, yeah. You know, it's like, and I guess this is something that's kind of an issue with humans anywhere on the planet, you know? People feel like, you know, if it doesn't happen to you, then it's not possible, you know, or, yeah. And a lot of times it's like, until this, you know, something happens, you feel like it could never happen to you, you know? And
but that's the problem. You know, you have to be prepared for the shit when it happens. So you're fucking prepared. You don't need something to happen for you to get, you know, oh, your mindset. Oh shit. I should do that. I should know that. I should know, you know, try that. I should learn that, you know?
Right, and by the time you come to that realization, it's too late. You know, the event passed, so now you're reacting, and
reaction is always slower than the action. You know,
right, and even like so, you know, you say there's like a lot of Alps in your country, right? It's a good place to vacation. Even, you know, having basic knowledge of bleeding control and tourniquet use would be great for, you know, people are skiing or something. You have an accident. You know, for hemorrhage control, you know, you throw in a tourniquet until you can get emergency responders there. You know what I mean? Like, even, you know, outside of the realm of police work or kind of like a terrorist attack, just that basic knowledge, you know, a car crash, you know, if your leg gets twisted up and, you know, maybe you have a bilateral amputation in the lower leg. You know, if you have basic knowledge of bleeding control and you have a tourniquet on your person or in the car somewhere, you can potentially save someone's life, you know? The other day someone posted on Facebook, I think it was in Iran somewhere. Okay. This guy tried to rob a bank and I guess the citizens were like, they kind of thwarted his attempts. And then a police officer happened to be walking by, and so he pulled
out. I saw the video, yeah.
You saw it? Yeah, so.
Yeah, I saw the video.
So the guy.
He shot it. Yeah,
he shot him in the leg. And it's interesting because a lot of people, like, they'll kind of criticize police action in the States and say, oh, you know, maybe they should have shot him in the leg. Well, this video is an example of why that could be dangerous. So this Iranian police officer shot this guy in the leg. And I guess he hit an artery.
Permanently an artery.
Yeah, so the guy, like, bled out and died on camera, on the video, like, within 2 minutes, you know. And there was one guy in the crowd who, after the guy looked like he was pretty much gone, took his belt off and tried to tie the belt above the wound, but it was obviously too late. And, you know, in a situation like that, you know, had that police officer had that training about tourniquet use and bleeding control, or if, you know, that guy kind of jumped up a little quicker, maybe they could have saved that guy's life, you know. But I think that video is kind of a perfect example of people not having knowledge on what the consequences could be, you know.
Yeah, I saw the video. It's a good education video.
Right, I mean, it sucks for the guy, but it, like you said, it is something you can learn from, you know.
Yeah, it's good to know, you know, medical training. It's not even the ops. Like, let's say I had a couple courses here for people that work on rigs and stuff like that, you know, with heavy machines or whatever the fuck you work, you know, construction. It's possible everywhere you can fucking, you know. Even I had a friend back home because I study graphic design. His fucking arm got caught in the fucking printing machine, you know, amputated, you know. So it's not, you know, like you said, it's not it doesn't care what the fuck you do, basically. It's good to have at least some fucking knowledge of this shit.
Right, you know? And you know, if you know, you could potentially save someone's life, you could save a family member, you know, and
or yours at the end.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so one of your rotations, one of your deployments as a soft medic was to Afghanistan. You were deployed with a Green Beret unit?
Yeah. We got deployed with Green Beret, basically two ODAs, because one was there when we came, and we stayed with those guys for like, I think, three months, and then they switched, so we stayed with the other ODA also, like, for 3 or 4 months.
Okay. So the deployment, so it was like 7 months or something like that?
Altogether, it was almost like 8 months, basically, because we were the last rotation of the I'll say ISAF, because they later changed it to, I forgot how they call it now. I don't know, whatever.
Oh, you mean like the coalition, basically?
Yeah. So we were basically, let's say, our deployment was the first official SF deployment for the Slovenian our unit, let's say, call it like that. So it was like a big deal back home, because before that we did a lot of deployments to Iraq, Afghanistan, but none of that was like a, let's call it, official SF, you know, mentoring operation, or how to say it. No, let's say like that. It was the first official combat operation that the SF unit, for our SF unit, like that.
Okay, so yeah, like, oh. I know during the course of the Global War on Terror, the Marines, they developed their what's known as MARSOC, the Marine Special Operations.
MARSOC, yeah.
So they had their train up, and then when they were ready to roll, they deployed, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was with Navy SEALs. On their first deployment, and the SEALs, I guess, were kind of mentoring them and that sort of thing. So would that be kind of similar to what it was for you guys?
Not basically. We did like a lot of deployments before, but most of our deployments were mentoring the ANSF, so Afghanistan National Security Forces, or the Iraqi guys.
Okay.
We didn't do like, none of our previous deployment was like, let's say, official going out on missions with these guys, you know. Mostly it was mentoring or doing some our own, let's say, missions, which we're not that big. Because, like I said, a small country, small unit, you always need to have a partner, a bigger country. So this one was like officially, even like in like a combat unit, like a combat operation. A large scale combat operation, let's say it like that.
Okay. So can you share with the audience perhaps a story of one of the operations that you guys went on, like just to give people kind of an understanding of what you guys were going through?
Yeah, sure. So let's say our like main course was basically mentoring PRC, like provincial response company. So it's like a special unit of their police, something like that. So we did mentoring them, and we did operations with that, from armed reconnaissance to direct actions to basically high value targets. Really depends. A story, I don't know, there's a couple of them. One is particularly interested how this works is, there was a big valley that was known, the Taliban were using it for like their stronghold. Even you had during our stay, some SAS guys tried to storm that valley. They got one of their dogs got captured. One of their guys got killed or something. Like four nationals got killed. I forgot. So it was like a not cleaned out valley, because when the coalition forces came to clean it up, let's say a couple of years ago, and then nobody came there for quite some time, so the Taliban put a big stronghold there. So we went on operation. It was us, our guys, the national guys, PRC. There was ANA. I don't know even who the fuck was there. When you find yourself in a bunch of people who don't have uniforms, don't have anything, they have weapons, you don't even know who the fuck is this.
Yeah.
Local police, national fucking police, uniform police. So the operation was pretty big. There was like around, I'm going to lie, but let's say around like, say 900 fucking people altogether,
Okay.
And it was maybe, let's say 30 of us guys, us and the US guys. So the plan was basically just, to get two teams, one team to go up to a hill and have like a overwatch, and the other team to try and, clean the valley up a little bit. So let's say I was in the overwatch team. So we had like maybe 300 people, let's say, and it was three of us Slovenians and two Americans, basically, and all other were the nationals. So until we got on the top of the fucking hill, and that was like, let's say, 1 hour, 2 hour walk, it was five of us guys, one interpreter, one PRC guy, and one ANA guy from 300 people. So
that actually made it up the hill.
Yeah. So it was like pretty interesting to see how people fucking disappeared while you were going like deeper and deeper inside. So we exchanged some fire up there, got in a small firefight, called in some CAS, but these motherfuckers are, whoever says these motherfuckers don't know how to fucking fight, like, I think he never been to fucking Afghanistan or somewhere.
Right.
Because, we had fucking, fucking Apaches over them and that shit. And they were like still fucking hitting us. Like usually they hide, but like in this valley, it was, they knew the fucking terrain. They knew fucking everywhere. So it was pretty interesting, let's say it. But like I said, the most interesting part was like, from 300 people, going to the mountain and only fucking 10 people come up there. So when the op was over and we had to go back, while we were going back, it was like suddenly 10 people, 20 people, 30 people, 40, 100. And then we suddenly got a call from up above, like, can you, You guys turn your strobes on and that shit, because I really don't know who the fuck is anymore who. Yeah. So that's one of the stories, like how shit works there, basically. So
right.
You're supposed to mentor them, but you basically they just use you for fucking, you know, to fight instead of them.
Right, and that's, you know, if anyone kind of pays attention to anything that happens in Afghanistan, I think that's kind of it's not very uncommon for Afghanistan, yeah. You know.
So yeah, it's you know, you could always know, like, you know, another story is like we were going to like clean some like a warehouse or some shit, you know, we come there, it was like four of us trucks and one of the fucking nationals, and I talked to one of the Green Berets. I was like, hey, I think we're gonna get shot right now. Like 2 minutes later we were in a firefight, you know.
Wow.
It's like shit is so obvious, so
yeah,
you know. But fuck it, that, you know, that's how it works.
Right.
No. Not the best story, maybe, you know, I don't know. But you know, it's a funny story.
No, it's cool, man. So now you have your deployment. Did you get out of the military shortly afterwards, or did you stay in for a while?
I stayed in for a while. I was a selection. I was instructor on the selection. I was instructor on the basic training. Did some cross training again. Was supposed to go to Iraq now to support the Kurds, but was supposed to go to the States for some more training. But you know, like I said, small country, small unit, there's like a big political effect on our unit, especially because, like I told you, the mentality in our country is like, you know, nothing is happening here. So I just got that feeling like that, you know, you train, you do all that shit, and, you know, they don't let you off the leash. You know what I mean? So,
right.
And I'm like, I don't know if I can take this. You know, doing all this and not getting the, you know, the right opportunity to let it out. So I said, fuck this. So I went out.
And how long has it been since you left the Slovenian military?
So I left, January this year. So it's not that long.
Oh, okay. So that's okay.
Yeah. Not that long. Like I said before, I did some work with some other, let's call it agency. So it was more convenient also for me to leave the army because, you know, it's hard to balance both of it. And then started doing some private security. Then I went to Africa, did some private security. So, you know, just trying to find myself or whatever they call it these days.
Yeah. All right, cool, man. So are you done with like the whole security type of work, or are you still just not really sure?
Basically I'm still like, the problem with the security right now is like, you know, there's a lot of market got open for a lot of, don't get me wrong, but for a lot of Romanians, Bulgarians and stuff like that, which are working for, you know, small money, so the companies are fucking using that big time, you know.
I see.
And to get in like a big good company, it's hard for us guys, especially because, you know, Slovenia, like where the fuck is that? Even with all the qualification and all this shit, you know, it's hard to get a good job. So right now I'm like, you know, between jobs, let's say, trying to get some shit and working some other shit.
Right. I see what you mean, man. So, all right, cool, man. So it's great having you on. I haven't seen much or heard much from any kind of Slovenian military or specifically SOF before. You know, I think people are really gonna enjoy, you know, listening to your perspective and hearing things from your point of view.
Yeah, I know. We'll be hiding. We're small. We've been hiding, and it's time for us. Go out there and, you know, show people that you can do the same shit like everybody else. You know, it doesn't matter where you fucking came or who the fuck are you. No, you can shine.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, cool, brother. So it was nice talking to you, man.
Good here, man.
You know, if you want to come back on, or, you know, you have anything you want to kind of talk about, you know, we could definitely get you back on.
you ever have any topics like, you know, medicine and all like medic shit, you know, if you want to have a talk, no worries, man. Just give me a buzz.
All right, cool. Thanks, brother. I appreciate everything. Man.
No worries, man. Anytime. If you come back in Norway anytime, let me know, you know. Beers are known to me.
Nice. Cool conversation with Siddiq. I haven't heard much from any Slovenian military, let alone a soft medic. And it's kind of interesting because a country like that is so small. And I guess, you know, with everything that happens globally, people don't really pay attention to these kind of smaller countries. But, you know, they do contribute to the fight. And, you know, it's, I guess it's interesting to hear from people like that. And I know, do you have any experiences like cross-training with other militaries, medics specifically, or anything like that?
Yeah, we always, every exercise usually that involves whichever brigade you're attached to, or there's always a counterpart. We do a lot of cross-training with, obviously, with you guys, with the Americans and Australians, Canadians. I'm not too sure. We do a little bit with some of the European armies. And I know, obviously, in my time in Afghanistan, we were working, you know, we had parts of the Belgian military and people like that around. But it's, yeah, I always find it really interesting because there are people work in different climates. The Australians are particularly good because their climate's very, it's not the same as the Middle East, but they do get very, you know, dry sort of desert conditions.
Right.
Yeah, and it's always, I find it really interesting. It's cool. You know, I always like to look at people, and it's quite funny, and this is just me because I'm a Brit, is because everyone thinks their kit's shit. You know, it's always like you get to a point like that, and then you always see other military's kit, and you're always exchanging stuff. I used to always be exchanging ration packs.
Oh, right, because the difference between, like, the MREs and what you guys are having?
And ours are really, like, they're fit for purpose. Don't get me wrong; they pack down really small, but they don't. They're probably better now, but when I sort of first started, they were terrible. You know, they were just really hideous. And then I remember, you know, my first sort of viewing of an MRE, seeing a bag of M&Ms, and it was like the Holy Grail. You know, it was amazing. And then there was one. And this is so sad, really. That I was getting a lot of joy from a piece of lemon pound cake. You know, just, it's just weird, isn't it? It's the little things like that kind of. But yeah, I think our militaries have always been like that, and in particular, our sort of soft communities are—they're sort of in each other's units all the time, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. And he, you know, he's on his rotation when he went into Afghanistan. They deployed with a Special Forces ODA. So
yeah, wow.
Yeah, it's good.
And that's the thing. The interesting thing is. We all go together, and if you don't, so you know, certain people are better in certain roles, and that's just the way it is. And I'm sure everyone's had their sort of their piece of the pie, if you like, haven't they? Because no one's really come away unscathed,
right?
You know, and it's interesting. It's an interesting it's interesting to see how other militaries view things. You know, how they, for instance, view alcohol in theaters and different things. That's always quite interesting culturally.
Right. I remember reading a book called Task Force Black. I forget the author's name, but he's a British journalist. And he was talking about the tier one components in Baghdad during the height of the war with the SAS and Delta, and how they were compound basically right next to each other. And at some point they like
high-fiving over the wall.
Yeah, right. And they like blew a hole through the wall so they could like go in between the compounds. And the Americans weren't allowed to drink, but the British were. They could drink. So I think, like, you know, every couple of days they would have some beers and a barbecue while the Americans were over there, like, drinking salsa water and shit like that. So it's kind of interesting.
No, and you mentioned those two units, but I think, obviously, historically, they're very, a very tight unit, aren't they? Or very tight friends and stuff. But, and that is, it's nice. It's nice when you have that sort of relationship, I think.
Yeah,
and even when it comes to, and I noticed this actually, in, you know, it sort of boils over from it starts with in the military, and then when you go into the sort of the private sector, it's exactly the same. You know, you can end up, I've actually probably worked with more foreign militaries since I left the British Army, and it's no bad thing. It's interesting.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, there's a lot to learn from, you know, working with other professionals, you know.
Yeah, it's quite funny because like you say, there is a lot to learn, and then there's also sometimes a lot not to take on.
Right. Right.
But that's that's par for the course, isn't it? So you're not going to sort of like everything, but by and large, the experiences that I've had has been really good.
Right. All right, cool. So, all right, with that, we'll close out the episode. You can check out Chantel on social media. On Facebook, it's Battle Worn, the Memoir of a Combat Medic in Afghanistan. Instagram is Mission_Critical. And you can also catch her book anywhere that books are sold. Just search on, I guess Amazon's probably the easiest place. You can search for Battle Worn on there and you can find her book. It's very good. And,
thanks. You've got to say that, John. You're not going to say, oh, my co-host wrote a shit book.
Yeah, it sucks. Don't buy it, bro.
It's just cheap. It's cheap for a download. So if you have Kindle.
Yeah, so my website is globalrecon.net. Oh, actually, I take that back. Let me rewind. We are gearing up to start putting out articles on a kind of a consistent basis for my website. And, you know, we got a good team of guys who are getting ready to do some good writing. So if anyone is interested in writing any articles for the website, we have SOF writers, special operations guys, infantry guys. It doesn't have to be someone with a military background, but we do prefer someone who has subject matter expertise in foreign policy, military history, that kind of thing. And if you're interested in that, send an email to john@globalrecon.net and we can discuss it further. So my website is globalrecon.net. My Facebook is FB Recon. On Instagram, my first account is IG Recon. The second account is Black Ops Matter. I'm on Twitter at IG Recon. And I'm on LinkedIn. Just search Global Recon. As always, I encourage you guys to share the episodes, download, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And that way, we'll continue to give you high-quality content as we stay at the top of the charts on iTunes, government, and national categories. All right, so we'll see you guys in a couple of days with another episode. Peace.